I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama held his first full news conference in 4 months today and faced questions about the economy, health care, but also that individual from Florida, the pastor the president didn't name, but again urged to rethink his plan to burn Korans. Well, we'll have more on Pastor Terry Jones with Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center, who's been tracking the pastor and his church for a year. As you know, that center tracks hate groups. We'll ask Mark about the pastor and also about the president's remarks on him. But first, the president began today with what observers say will be the Democrats' theme this fall, that Americans have a choice between his policies, which he says saved the country from depression, or the Republicans' policies, which he says brought the U.S. to recession. And the president admitted again, there's a lot more to do.
Even though the economy is growing again, and we've added more than 750,000 private sector jobs this year, the hole the recession left was huge. And progress has been painfully slow. Millions of Americans are still looking for work. Millions of families are struggling to pay their bills or the mortgage.
Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post joins us now. And Karen, we thought the questions right away would be about the whole hoopla over the Florida pastor and all the news of the past day, but they were largely about the economy. So let's start there. What jumped out at you?
Well, what struck me was that the president had clearly a number of goals here. One was to try to, as he had said earlier in the week, if this is a referendum on where the economy is, the Democrats are going to do very poorly in this election. So he really did try to focus, as he said, on things going forward and what the choices going forward are. He once again was, on the one hand, talking about wanting to work with the Republicans on something to extend some of the Bush tax cuts, but was once again very inflexible about the idea of extending them for people who make over $250,000, as now, by the way, even some Democrats are suggesting be done on a temporary basis. And I was struck, too, that he gave a couple of shout-outs to Senator Voinovich, the retiring Ohio Republican, who has also said that there does need to be, you know, a vote on the administration's proposal on the tax cuts.
Well, let's listen to some of the president. Again, he wants to keep the Bush-era tax cuts, which are set to expire. He says for the 97% of Americans making less than $250,000, these are families, he says, the Republicans wants to keep the cuts for everyone, including the very wealthy. Here's the president's response.
So these policies of cutting taxes for the wealthiest Americans, of stripping away regulations that protect consumers, running up a record surplus to a record deficit, those policies finally culminated in the worst financial crisis we've had since the Great Depression. And for 19 months, what we have done is steadily worked to avoid a depression, to take an economy that was contracting rapidly and start making it grow again, a situation where we're losing 750,000 jobs a month, and now we've had 8 consecutive months of private sector job growth.
I apologize, Karen. That was actually the president's full statement about what he feels his administration has done. But as far as the tax cuts go, he once again said that the Republicans want to save, you know, millionaires $100,000, and he doesn't think that that money is worth it.
Well, you know, one problem he has here in arguing this is that, you know, if there isn't something done in Congress, all the tax cuts expire at the end of the year, including the tax cuts for people making under $250,000 a year. So there is a real question here of whether he is ultimately going to have to bend on this. And even earlier this week, his own very recently departed OMB director, Peter Orszag, argued that maybe what everybody ought to be thinking of is essentially kicking this can down the road for 2 years and just extending everything for 2 years.
Sure. I mean, Republicans interpreted Orszag's comments about, passing all of the tax cuts on as meaning that he meant that they were fiscally a good idea, but he was saying politically it's a good idea to pass them just to get something passed.
That's right. And again, because if if the stalemate continues, essentially, you know, people making under $250,000 a year are also going to see their taxes go up at the end of the year.
Well, the president also talked about his plan to build infrastructure, his other plans for small businesses and other business so that they could, for instance, write off equipment that they buy now into 2011 to somehow stimulate spending that way. He was asked about that, thinking that he's got, you know, this economic package. Let's listen to OBA 5 in the studio.
So this is a second stimulus.
You know, the here's how I would. There is no doubt that everything we've been trying to do, is designed to stimulate growth and additional jobs in the economy. I mean, that's our entire agenda. So I have no problem with people saying the president is trying to stimulate growth and hiring.
But Karen Tumulty, he wouldn't say stimulus.
That's right. It was a sort of a semantic cat and mouse game. I think in part because while, you know, I think most economists agree that the situation we're in would have been probably worse if the government hadn't passed the previous stimulus. It is, you know, it has been discounted on both sides. The right, you know, believes that it was, you know, just a big new hole in the deficit. And, you know, the left is angry because they don't think it was big enough.
Well, I want to move on to the other topic that did come up, although late in the press conference, a full, it seemed, half hour in after discussion of the economy. He was asked, first of all, about sort of the rise in angst and anxiety about Islam. Why does he think this is happening now, 9 years after 9/11, as we come up on the anniversary? What was his response?
Well, it was interesting because this was one of the rare times that we've ever heard him praise former President Bush. He said that one of the things that he admired about President Bush was that he had made the point right after 9/11 that, quote, we were not at war with Islam. And President Obama described himself as having been proud of the country for rallying the idea around that idea. But he did not try to sort of deconstruct this so much as he just sort of reaffirmed his commitment to, you know, staving off this rise of anti-Muslim sentiment. And it was interesting, too, that he spoke directly of his own Christian faith and said, you know, that this has been one of the things that has sustained him in office.
And asked people to, you know, hold on to what is one of their values, religious tolerance. He was asked about that individual in Florida. He wasn't named, but it's Pastor Terry Jones, who, of course, we're going to outline the last 2 days of news from him. But essentially, of course, he threatened to burn Korans. There's a question as to whether or not he will do that. But when asked about it, he once again asked the pastor to look to his better angels, but also said this.
I'm also commander-in-chief, and we are seeing today riots in Kabul, riots in Afghanistan that threaten our young men and women in uniform. And so we've got an obligation to send a very clear message that this kind of behavior or threats of action put our young men and women in harm's way. And it's also the best imaginable recruiting tool for Al-Qaeda. And although this may be one individual in Florida, part of my concern is to make sure that we don't start having a whole bunch of folks all across the country think this is the way to get attention. This is a way of endangering our troops, our sons and daughters.
Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, your thoughts.
Well, it was interesting because he was actually on the defensive in that question. He was asked, did he not think that by addressing this, as he put it, individual in Florida, he was actually elevating him. And so the president explained why they did it, but it was interesting because there was just a tiny indirect bit of media criticism, I think, in there as well when he said, you know, we're not the ones who elevated this. And I think, you know, again, it was a sort of the argument being that this had turned into a media phenomenon that they had to deal with.
Well, it certainly is a phenomenon, and one we want to take a look at. We're going to do that right now as we say thank you. Karen Tomalty of The Washington Post with the latest on President Obama's 8th White House news conference. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Well, after a call from Defense Secretary Robert Gates and some backtracking yesterday, Florida Pastor Terry Jones said early today that his Koran burning event planned for the anniversary of 9/11 remains canceled, and he plans to travel to New York today to meet with the imam who had plans to build an Islamic center near Ground Zero. Apparently, though, no meeting is scheduled, so that's all hazy. But what is true about Pastor Terry Jones? Mark Potok is with the Southern Poverty Law Center in Alabama. You may know they track hate groups, and they've actually been tracking Pastor Terry Jones and his Dove World Outreach Center in Gainesville, Florida, for about a year now. So, Mark, come on in on this. First of all, you listened in on the president's press conference. How do you feel about his responses to questions about an increase in anxiety about Islam, but also about that individual from Florida?
Well, I mean, I think he was right to praise former President Bush. I think it is one of the decent things that Bush did back then, and clearly a Republican president speaking at that moment in the days and weeks after 9/11 as strongly as he did about the idea of, you know, Muslims are not our enemy, Arabs are not our enemy, and so on, had a genuine effect. You know, hate crimes shot up by 1,700% immediately after 9/11, anti-Muslim hate crimes, that is. But they fell again by some two-thirds in 2002, just 3.5 months later. And I think that that was very, very largely attributable to what the president said. You know, it's a different situation now in that really, at least in my view, this whole business of Islam being the enemy and so on has been brought up not by the real fringe nuts like Terry Jones in Gainesville, but by people like Newt Gingrich, and you know, who compares Muslims to Nazis, or to the National Republican Trust Political Action Committee, you know, which has run television ads saying that the proposed Islamic Center in New York, it would be a, quote, celebration of the murders of 3,000 Americans.
Well, and we want to ask you more about Newt Gingrich's comments. And he said it shouldn't have been called a war on terrorism, implying it should have been called a war on Islam, which some are saying is falling right into the hands of, as the president said, recruiters. But in the minute we have till the break, you've said in the past you thought President Obama was cowardly in his statements on that Islamic center, saying everyone has a right to build it, but then seeming to take that back. Do you think he made a strong statement today?
Yeah, I think it was fairly strong, and I think what he said was perfectly decent. I did think it was a terrible shame the way he backed away immediately. I mean, he had plainly said on one day that he thought the center should be built, and then completely took that back the next day. So that seemed obviously responding to polls and nothing more.
Mark Potok with the Southern Poverty Law Center. We have so many questions. Should the Secretary of Defense have called up the pastor in Florida? What role did the media play in fanning these flames? Why isn't it a hate crime to incite riots in Afghanistan? More questions for Mark Potok in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center about both Pastor Terry Jones, the Florida minister who's threatened to burn Korans, and also about the president's press conference today. And Mark, the president was asked as the press conference closed how he felt about the Islamic Center being built near Ground Zero in New York. And he said that anything should be able to be built there, a mosque, a synagogue, a church. He pointed out that Americans are Muslims. There are American Muslims. There's not an us and them, reminding Americans of that. And we want to ask you, too, about the conflation of the Islamic Center And the story from Florida. You've been tracking the Florida pastor. To our knowledge, he has not been talking about the Muslim center proposed in New York, but he was quite a bit yesterday. Let's remind people, saying that an imam from Florida approached him about a deal that the New York imam would move the center in New York if he agreed to not burn the Korans. The pastor, Terry Jones, announced this, and then shortly afterwards, the imam in New York said, "We haven't made a deal, but there may still be a meeting between the two in New York." What do you think about that sudden brush fire of stories?
Well, I mean, I do think that the media has played a role in this. I mean, from my point of view, this guy, Terry Jones, is at the absolute fringe of the fringe. A mere few months ago, when the media paid absolutely zero attention to him, this guy was putting signs outside of his church saying, "No homo mayor." This was in reference to a city commissioner who was an openly gay man running for mayor of Gainesville, a man who in fact became mayor of Gainesville. So, you know, he's a sort of political arsonist. I mean, this guy runs around, denouncing Hindus, denouncing gay people, and now Islam. One of the things I note is that when he was running a kind of cult-like church in Cologne, Germany, some of the members have recently been quoted as saying, "We threw him out in part because he was always a publicity seeker. All he wanted was personal fame."
But Mark Potok, what are you saying? I mean, some are saying, and our listeners have said, that this is a self-inflicted media wound, that the media gave him the platform. But we know we didn't cover him until there were already riots in Afghanistan at that point. Don't you have to?
Well, yes, I do think you have to. I mean, I think what really happened was the BBC picked it up, and it became essentially an international story. And I don't spend a lot of time beating the media up on this. I'm just saying that, normally, how much media attention does a guy like Fred Phelps get, the guy who runs the God Hates Fags website and
shows up at funerals,
people's funerals and
right.
so on. I think what's really happened is that this man has been able to profit immensely from what was produced really by politicians, the debate around Ground Zero, or at least that debate going national, and then the kind of consequent wave of attacks on mosques and so on around the country.
In Tennessee and elsewhere. Well, let's pick up on that, because when we left before the break, you were talking about feeling that politicians like Newt Gingrich had fanned the flames by the language that they used around the debate over the cultural center. President Obama said today, "We are not at war against Islam, but against terrorist factions." And yet this week we heard Republican leaders like John Boehner conflate the issue of the cultural center and the right to burn Korans, which, by the way, by the end of the week, the pastor also was. What do you think happened there?
Well, I mean, obviously they are similar only in one way, in that they involve constitutional freedoms. The freedom of religion most certainly allows the building of the Islamic Center at its present location in New York, just as the Constitution protects this unpleasant man in Florida in his plan, or not plan, depending on what minute it seems to be, to burn Korans. So, in that way, they're similar. But, of course, every bit of evidence we have, I think, makes very clear that the intentions of the imam and his outfit in New York are quite honorable. Whereas this is a person, Terry Jones, who seems to be rather willing to not only attack a huge number of people, but actually put our own people in danger in terms of, riots in Afghanistan, and Iraq, wherever it may be. They're dissimilar in that sense, the motivations of the people.
And you say that, but what do you say to the people in New York and elsewhere who don't see it as being honorable? I mean, this is an old debate. It's been going on for a couple of months now. But, this is an imam in New York who was plucked by the Bush administration out of obscurity because he was so moderate. And they sent him around the world to try to heal relations between Muslims and American and America, and but people somehow perceive it, or were told it was an insult to them that this was built there. I mean, how do you tell them that it's not a hateful thing when it feels that way to them?
when it feels that way to relatives of victims' families, that kind of thing?
Yeah, people in New York who feel that it feels like an insult to them. It feels hateful to build something that reminds them of the faith, the fundamentalist faith behind the people that attacked the towers.
Well, I think the answer is not to call those people names or accuse them of being, you know, Muslim-hating extremists or wicked people. I mean, they have a right to their feelings, and the attack in New York was an incredible thing. That said, however, I think the reality is that it is not a hateful act. You know, the man, the imam, may or may not have been an obscure person, but I think that his record suggests pretty clearly that, you know, his intention is not, as some have suggested, to pave the way for Muslim domination of the United States or to celebrate the murders of all these people.
And Mark Kochak, I'm up against the wall. I just got to ask you in 40 seconds, why is it not a hate crime to burn the Korans? We know it's not a crime to burn any books, but if it incites riots, and that is what we understand a hate crime is, if it might lead to, violence and someone being injured, why isn't it a hate crime?
Well, it's not a hate crime. The only crime that it could be charged as is some kind of incitement, but criminal incitement requires a real immediacy. You know, I can say all Jews should be killed, and that is a completely protected statement. That's not incitement. It's
Mark
a
Potok.
General kind of action.
Mark Potok, always enjoy talking to you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Back in the break. Here now. Firefighters in San Bruno, California, are still dealing with that smoldering wreckage after that massive gas explosion last night. Dozens of homes destroyed, the final death toll not known. Paul Foster is a San Bruno resident who fled his home after the explosion.
The fire crews were just beginning to arrive, and probably for about a block and a half away, I could see a humongous orange fireball that appeared to be coming out of the middle of the street.
A ruptured gas line is suspected. People reported smelling gas to the utility company, so there is a lingering question as to whether or not the utility responded. But meanwhile, in Detroit, the fires that were swept by wind through a neighborhood on Tuesday have been put out, and the heat is still on city officials. Detroit Mayor Dave Bing called the fires a natural disaster, but residents are complaining that their calls to 911 went unanswered because of budget cuts. Melanie Scott is a reporter for the Detroit Free Press. Melanie, how did these fires start?
Many of the fires are believed to have started by down power lines. I know in one of the neighborhoods that I covered, residents reported they heard a crack to a transformer and then they saw sparks, which precipitated a fire of a garage, which spread to homes and other garages.
Yeah, there's also reports of some arson, other fires that might have started by illegal hookups to utility lines.
Mm-hmm.
But these were fires that, as you said, a garage fire that could have been put out. What are they saying about the fire engines that didn't come?
The firefighters were overwhelmed. So you've got trucks going from one side of town to another side of town. In some cases, suburban communities just decided to jump in. They heard what was going on, and they decided to help.
Well, and we understand that there was some embarrassment there because some of these suburban fire crews got to some of these fires. There were no Detroit firefighters there, and we know 8 of Detroit's 66 companies
mm-hmm.
were idled because of budget cuts.
Correct.
So what is the city saying? I mean, obviously Detroit has more financial problems than a lot of cities,
mm-hmm.
car industry and everything, but a lot of cities are looking at shutting down fire departments because of budget cuts. What
Correct.
Is Detroit saying?
Officials are still trying to process what happened here. They're still investigating response times, just trying to assess what the time delay was.
In the meantime, tell us some of the stories of what residents had to do on their own.
Some of them hooked up their own hoses. Many of them used buckets filled with water from their homes to try to fight these fires on their own. But there were high winds that day, and it just spread quickly.
Your mayor says that the winds made this a natural disaster.
Mm-hmm.
But do we understand that some people even actually tried to drive to the fire stations?
Yes, some people did, and either they encountered the fire stations were already out, or they just didn't get answers.
We understand there are questions as well for Detroit Energy. What about?
Many residents are questioning, if the company failed to maintain the infrastructure of the utility lines. Some residents have said that they complained earlier in the day of down power lines, and they were told that crews would come out from the energy company, but they didn't see them, and then the fire started.
Well, Melanie, the pictures are stunning.
Mm-hmm.
Describe, the aftermath of these fires. How many fires were there? How many buildings or homes were burned?
There were about 85 fires. They're unclear on how many homes exactly were burned because many of the fires were just contained to garages. When I arrived to the scene of one neighborhood, firefighters were working frantically on several structures. One particular block had three homes that were burning at the same time, as well as about six garages. And they were trying to prevent the fire from reaching the other homes, but you've got these flames engulfing homes in the middle of the block. And it was a scene where, people were trying to get to their homes, trying to prevent fires on their property, but they're also trying to help out their neighbors. They're also trying to, offer their neighbors shelter. And I think the most heartwarming thing out of this is the way I've seen residents come together and bind together. For instance, yesterday, one family went back to their home to see the damage, and they were greeted by hugs from their neighbors, and they were offering them clothes, and they were just offering food or anything that they could to help these families cope.
That's Melanie Scott with the Detroit Free Press. Melanie, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Well, still ahead, if 9/11 was also your birthday, could you celebrate on such a somber day? That's in 30 seconds, here and now. The dream is alive. I'm speaking, of course, of the dream of tennis fans that Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal will face off in the finals of the U.S. Open. This after Nadal dispensed with fellow Spaniard Fernando Verdasco last night. But there's still plenty of play and the windy weather to contend with before those finals. John Wertheim has been following the action for Sports Illustrated. So, John, are people at Flushing Meadows buzzing about this possible finals match?
They're buzzing and they're swirling. This Nadal-Federer final, which is sort of the, for my money, as good a rivalry as there is in sports, never mind tennis. We haven't seen these two guys meet in a major final in more than a year now. And it would be great if that would happen. But, boy, the wind has really sort of hijacked these last few days as far as the storyline goes. I mean, to me, as a, not a professional meteorologist, it's all very strange that I haven't seen anything like this in years past, but it's really affecting everything.
Global warming or something. But, it raises the old debate about whether or not there should be a roof there on the Flushing Meadow courts. Should there be?
I think absolutely. In the past, including last year, we had this debate because of the rain. Now we have another meteorological element. So I think, maybe ironically enough, it's wind and not rain that's going to cause this
roof. Right. Well, so there's the weather to contend with. And before the finals, other terrific matches. You've got Mikhail Yuzny, who is going to take on Nadal, and Novak Djokovic, a crowd favorite, who will challenge Federer in Saturday's semifinals. Do people think that either one might be a spoiler?
Well, it's funny. I mean, Djokovic was sort of hailed fairly recently even as sort of this third leg of the rivalry and the guy who could really sort of make it a rivalry, as it were. It's never really happened. He's been a very solid player for a long time. He's good on the surface. But it just seems as though he doesn't quite have that extra gear that Federer and Nadal do. And then in the other match, Yuzny is a very nice player, but I would be absolutely shocked if he were to beat Nadal. I think Federer losing to Djokovic is the more likely spoiler scenario.
So that's on Saturday on the men's side. On the women's side, in the semis, today, number one seed Caroline Wozniacki and number seven seed Vera Zvonareva are playing on our watch, so we know people like to watch at night. We're not going to touch that. But your thoughts on the match coming up later today between Kim Clijsters and Venus Williams?
I think the Clijsters-Williams match, a lot of people are seeing sort of as the de facto final. They've both won multiple Grand Slams. And I think, the women's draw coming in was sort of this subject of derision, and Serena wasn't playing, and Justine Henin, another fine player, wasn't playing. And we had this Wozniacki, who's really never won a big prize, as the number one seed. And the women's draw has really held its own. Wozniacki has played up to form and has looked like a number one seed. And then Clijsters, a defending champion, I think is probably the best bet to win this. Of course, Venus Williams has had this long and storied career. But it's nice to see that the women's draw, which a lot of people were sort of mocking before the tournament, actually has served up some good tennis, and there's still, four good players left.
That's Sports Illustrated's John Wertheim. time at the U.S. Open in New York. John, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
I happened to overhear a conversation recently at yoga class, of all places. When's your birthday? 9/11. Mine too, someone said. Me too, from another person. It's a weird club to belong to, as we're about to hear. Jennifer Lady is now a forensic scientist in New York. But Jennifer, we understand you were in Virginia in 2001 on 9/11, your birthday. What were you thinking?
Well, you know, I was thinking good thoughts. I was thinking it was my birthday and it was going to be a fun day, frankly. And I remember where I was when it happened, obviously, as I'm sure everybody does. And I was in the gym working out when it came on the TV there.
Yeah. Well, and what does it do to that day going forward?
Well, I don't know. Now that I live in New York, I think it's a little heavier than it would be if I lived somewhere else. But I also just feel like enough time has passed that I do think of it as a, you know, a national tragedy, but I also think of it as my birthday, and I don't equate the two. And when I told people what my birthday was, the reaction has always been sort of a, oh, wow, gosh, you know, just sort of a stunned, not really disbelief, but sort of a, gee, I'm really sorry. But, you know, yesterday I was making a doctor's appointment, and the receptionist asked me my birthday, and I told her. And she said, oh, that's my birthday, too. And I said, happy birthday. And she said, well, happy birthday to you. And I think that was the first time somebody did not react to my birthday as the date that it was, which was kind of interesting.
It's Jennifer Lady. Jennifer, thank you. Patty Frick is Jennifer's friend and also a 9/11 birthday. Patty is in L.A. Patty, we just heard Jen say that her feelings about 9/11 and her birthday have changed. Is that true for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the year or two, maybe three, 4 years after, you think, yeah, you know, this is a bummer. This is my birthday. A lot of people suggest, well, you should celebrate your birthday on a different day. You know, make it September 10th. You know, now it feels sort of random. You know, maybe it was going to happen on a day. It was going to be somebody's birthday. You know, I've had a lot of people liken it to all the people who had their birthday on December 7th and then Pearl Harbor happened. So, you know, there are two different things. One's sad and tragic, and then you have your birthday, and that's a good thing.
And what do you plan to do on your birthday?
You know, celebrate as I normally would, getting together with some friends for dinner. And, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about 9/11 because it kind of always comes up.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a kid, that was usually the first week of school. So it was always sort of a time of like, oh, you're going back to school, summer's over. And that was always my association, my birthday. You know, sometimes it was the first day of school, and then the association has changed, obviously.
Patty Frick. Patty, thank you. Well, as I mentioned, I overheard a conversation about 9/11 birthdays, and one of the participants was George Middleton, a firefighter in Carlisle, Massachusetts. And, George, I'm wondering if, you know, as a firefighter, in addition to all the thoughts you might have and the birthday thoughts, you'll have other, perhaps more somber thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we always think of those who have gone on, and, you know, I've got a special shirt I wear on 9/11 that honors those whose lives were lost, and I send some prayers their way. And so, yeah, you think of that for sure.
Do you remember 9 years ago? I mean, was there a moment when you realized, you know, you're confronting the enormity of what's happening to the whole country, but was there a moment where you kind of went, oh, and it's also my birthday?
At some point I thought to myself, oh, geez, I'm really glad that we celebrated my birthday the day before with another friend of mine whose birthday is also on 9/11, who's also on the fire department. And the other connection is that I ended up down there at Ground Zero like a week later as a stress debriefer. I'm just hoping that practically 10 years later, the country is slowly starting to come around to the basic ideals of freedom and liberty and that kind of thing. And I sure hope they don't burn those Korans. Mm-hmm. Just be a real step backwards.
George Middleton, a firefighter in Carlisle, Massachusetts. Well, we wish George and everyone born on 9/11 a very happy birthday. And by the way, it was also my parents' anniversary. They're gone now, but the day can be a very special one for so many different reasons. So our best to everyone tomorrow. And by the way, what is being done to memorialize that day in New York? We'll have that story in 1 minute, here and now.
So
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. Well, as we've been hearing, there's been a lot of controversy over what might be built a few blocks from Ground Zero in New York, but what actually is being built right on the ground where the Twin Towers once stood. It's actually bustling with construction activity. More than 2,000 workers, all aware of the enormity of building on the site where almost 3,000 people were killed 9 years ago. Today, two new towers are going up on the site, including One World Trade Center, formerly called the Freedom Tower, which at 1,776 feet will be the tallest building in the U.S. Also, an entry to what will be a below-ground memorial museum, and above ground, a 4-acre memorial park with two great pools marking the footprints of the original towers. Architectural writer Philip Noble, author of 16 Acres, Architecture and the Outrageous Struggle for the Future of Ground Zero, joins us on his cell phone from the site. And Philip, what do you see there? Can you see those memorial pools?
If you walk around the site now, there are these high chain-link fences topped with barbed wire, and they're covered with sort of promotional propaganda from the Port Authority. But when you do the sort of walking tour around the perimeter, part of it takes you up into a bridge across the highway and then into the World Financial Center. So you're up two stories, and you can look across back into the site. And there, you can, if you know what you're looking at, you can very clearly see the two footprints of the towers that are going to be these kind of elaborate memorial pools.
Tell us about this. David Dunlop of the New York Times writes that there are enormous pumps standing by to send thousands of gallons of water cascading into the pools that are the footprint of the buildings. And people are saying this is going to be the largest human-engineered waterfall in the U.S.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that happened during the struggle to get to a final form of the site was that the idea of what was truly sacred went from the whole area, every place that had any kind of wreckage, down to the site itself. And then by the summer of 2002, it was really only those two 212-foot square sites where the building stood on the site. And the Governor Pataki stood up and said, you know, these footprints are hallowed ground and will remain so, and they have. But they make a very difficult site for the memorial because the buildings, if you remember, were huge. And so in the middle of this memorial park with its 400 trees, you're going to have these two 200-foot pits, you know, lined completely with water falling, I think, at least 20 feet. And then in the center, this is a sort of what separates it from any other kind of office park fountain apart from the scale and brings it sort of into a memorial, I think, is that in the center of each, there's a kind of hole that the water falls to out of sight. And, yeah, at the bottom of that, there'll be these giant pumping stations out of sight.
Trees. We know that several of the ultimately 400 white swamp oaks have been planted. They were picked because they grow to be very lofty and they're tenacious. Right. What else is going on in the area that we should know about?
There's going to be the kind of abstract memorial, you know, this contemplative park and the splashing water and these two huge pools. And then there's going to be a kind of interpretive museum on the site as well. And they just brought back to the site with some fanfare two of the kind of pitchfork-shaped columns that used to line the bottom of the Twin Towers. People have been calling them the Trident. And they're huge columns.
We understand they weigh 50 tons apiece, and that when they were first, you know, a part of the original towers and architects reviewed them back in 1973, they were said to be tarting up the buildings. But now they were the only things that were left standing on that day, and they looked sort of like trees, and they looked very heroic. So now they've come to really mean something to people.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting stories. This building that didn't mean anything except as an expression of commercial power has come to mean, you know, many, many things. But, these simple shapes that were really a structural solution, yeah, now they've come to mean, you know, rebirth and hope and resurgence. And I'm sure each person walking by me here has a different explanation.
Well, and what about underneath the hallowed ground? We understand that underground is going to be the formal National September 11th Memorial Museum, seven stories beneath street level. Down below ground in this museum will be a portion of the stairs that some survivors used to escape, and that a quotation from Virgil's Aeneid is going to be in the wall, "No day shall erase you from the memory of time." Reporters went on a tour in July. They said it's just very profound and raw to go down into the museum. And I'm wondering, Philip, What's it like to be where you are? Now, maybe you're a New Yorker, you've been there, you know, a few times, but I'm thinking that even thinking about being there might be, you know, just almost too emotional for some people. What does it feel like there?
You know, it's funny. I haven't been down here for a little while, and I just did what tourists do, and you come down and you sort of look for a place to focus your attention, and there's no center, you know, there's nothing. So people sort of naturally form this swirl around the site. The site is huge. It takes about half an hour to do this walk around it, and it's a very broken walk, and you go in and out of different blocks and up and down out of different bridges, and it's constantly changing as the needs of the construction are. And it's what I always find interesting are these really creative ways people find to mourn. People still post signs, even though now there's no official place where that's allowed anymore. There in the past there have been walls and walls of sort of hand drawn memorials that have just taken over different stretches, and those are all gone. But there's a map on the official kiosk, and someone has planted a picture of the old Twin Towers just, you know, right in the middle where they should have been, as a kind of, you know, mm-hmm. act of memory and defiance. It's a lot of impromptu grieving, you know, and then also just New York being New York. I mean, there's thousands of tourists here today, and then there's the people going to work,
going about their business. Yeah, and just your thoughts, you know, of course, Saturday, such an important day. We're hearing from analysts who say that it might be, I don't know, more about politics and debate over the proposed Islamic Center or the Qurans in Florida than the solemn, united day it's been in the past. What's the sense that you're getting?
The most poignant spot when you do this sort of pilgrimage tour is on the south side of the site is a firehouse called Ten House. You know, it's right across the street from the old World Trade Center, and they were the first of the first responders and lost, you know, some terrible percentage of their total company that day. They have a memorial to fallen firefighters, and there you do see, you know, people crying and leaving flowers and going through kind of more conventional memorial gestures. But right now it's New York as New York always is, and people are very tolerant and accepting. And I think in the city, and this is what's so tricky to understand about the site, is that it isn't the simple hallow ground that it's sometimes caricatured as in the media. And if you're looking for things that offend the idea of the site is sacred, you can also focus on the fact that it's going to have a huge shopping mall, you know, right in the site, and it's going to have market rate office space. The whole place is like the rest of New York. It's a complicated kind of overlap of uses, and there's no way, even in the memorial itself, the trains are going to wrap right around the outside of what's going to be that subterranean, you know, holy space. There's really no way to set aside one part as perfectly, unadulteratedly sanctified.
The sacred and the secular cheek to jowl.
Yeah, as they are everywhere in the city. Sure.
That's architecture writer Philip Noble at Ground Zero. Philip, thank you.
Thank you.